Good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We are a group that meets twice weekly. We're back to our regular schedule. Sunday mornings, as this morning, 11 till noon. And it is, the titles can be found in this pamphlet. This is the right one. Next week is Instinct and Intuition. And of course, today is the cause of sorrow. Wednesday nights, we are continuing our study in the Bhagavad Gita. We just finished chapter 14, I believe. So there's a schedule behind the usher, if you want to follow along. And the reference library is open on Wednesday nights from 5:15 till 7:15. And the meeting runs from 7:30 till 8:30. That has changed. It's a little bit earlier. So everything done at this lodge or any lodge around the world is completely sustained by voluntary effort. That could be your time, your service in whatever format, and of course money. Keep the lights on and the air moving and so forth. So whatever you can give, a dollar given in the right way with the right feeling goes a long way. And there's a small contribution box on top of the bookcase on the way out if you'd like it to be anonymous. Or you can give at the book table and talk to them about something you might want to do. Now, the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Now, this morning's topic is the cause of sorrow, and it's certainly one we can all identify with. So we'll have the first portion of it summarized, and then the chair will take questions.
So Sir Crosby emphasizes the cause of sorrow, in a nutshell, is due to our own ignorance and not understanding where to look for it. Once we look for it in the right place, we can cease to cause it. He says, we are never free from pain, from suffering, or sorrow in the world. If we could understand the cause of sorrow wherever we might look, not just the sorrow of our own petty issues, but the bigger issues, the sorrow we collectively bring upon ourselves, such as war, if we could see what the cause was, we would cease to make that cause. Many of us actually think that these collective sorrows are due to a condemning God or to other beings that are doing something to us. Therefore, many of us don't realize that or don't accept that we're actually connected to the very causes that bring about our sorrows because we attribute it to someone else doing something to us. Individually, collectively, because many of us don't think that actually it is we who are connected to these sorrows or to the cause and burden ourselves with sorrow. So because we don't feel that we're connected to it, we look for something or someone else outside, somewhere else, to stop causing us this sorrow. So whatever it or he or she out there is doing, we think is burdening us, and we don't want it to burden us anymore. So the very sorrows that actually we, in our own ignorance, are creating, we're attributing to someone else. So until we stop looking outside, we're never going to find the real cause. There's no religion, no ism, nor any materialistic scientific invention that is the solution to our sorrows. So long as we search outside of ourselves, we won't find it, because it lies within. Within each of us is the power to cause this sorrow, and therefore is the power to cease causing it. Theosophy explains the cause of sorrow. It's very simple in principle. Simply, each of us is spirit with infinite potency, and this potency is limited by us by the very way we think and use these forms. Within each of us, behind the form, is spirit, which is the cause and the sustainer of the form. The force, spirit is the force behind evolution. It is the force that rules and relates all things of whatever level of development. So all of nature is the expression of this force. We are the outcome of an unfoldment from within outward of spirit. As self-conscious beings, or as human beings, we have the power of choice. We can draw upon that source, that inner spirit. And if we recognize and accept the divinity of that source within us while we live in this ever-changing, this mortal body, we will come to recognize that we can cease these sorrows by working within. Our own unchecked desires is the cause of all sin, sorrow, and suffering. Selfish thoughts, unfulfilled desires for something more, bigger, greater. These desires, desiring all of this, that's not the original plan. All of our woes are self-inflicted. They are self-inflicted because of our own misuse of our own spiritual powers, individually and collectively. But sorrow and suffering can be put to good use. For one thing, when we become miserable enough, we can make certain changes. we can tend not to do the things anymore that cause such sorrow. Thus we look around and try to discern what is right in such and such a situation. We learn from mistakes of right and wrong, and we recognize the difference. So we have pairs of opposites. Pairs of opposites are tools for growth. Although we are one, our essence, our source is one in spirit, we are dual in expression, and this is necessary. Duality in our nature is necessary so that we can learn. Pleasure and pain, darkness and light, they're all two sides of the same coin in the sense that without one, we can't know the other. So we use each of them to find the balance, each of the different pairs of opposites. So that part of us which acts is also acted upon. This is karma. Behind the unfolding of intelligence from the lowest to the highest in nature is karma. That which acts is acted upon. Law rules according to karma. And here the law of periodicity is simply a statement of karma. On all planes, law is simply the perception of the action and reaction of various grades of intelligences. All of time's cycles are governed by this law of periodicity, or the law of cycles. We who form a nation were together in other times. Our collective actions as nations in the past have brought us together the same collective reactions. This is a collective karma among us. Our thoughts impress the astral light around us, and that impression into the astral light returns to us as thoughts, feelings, everything comes back. Thus, even the power of false, mistaken ideas returns to us. And in our ignorance, we can even sustain these false, mistaken ideas without end because of the law of the return of impression. We therefore sustain our own suffering because we hold these wrong ideas to be true. The power of spirit, used in right direction, with the knowledge of our own true spiritual nature and the nature of all in general, can bring about the cessation of our sorrows.
Thank you. It's a serious article, and it applies to us all. Yes. It's pointing to the fact that we are eternal, intelligent, spiritual beings, and that everything we do, we set into motion, has its return. So that being the case, once we recognize it, which is the hard part, that it comes from us, then the power to cease it happening becomes available to us. But the in-between stage when we think someone else is doing us harm or we can't figure out why this keeps coming to me or I keep wanting this is the work we have to do. Because what we make, we can unmake. Yes.
One that's observing, yes. And there's one that's going through the action. And sometimes we do feel that there is something there, because we get that sort of nod of intuition, something telling us this is not the way.
Yes. And that's next week, so we won't tread those waters.
Yeah.
But there are many, many signs for us to pay attention to along the way. This keeps giving me pain, yet I keep doing it. What's the desire that makes me want to keep doing it? Why do I not see that it's myself who is doing it? Yes.
It was mentioned that the way to alleviate sorrow is to have a conscious and aware unification with the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Where are the instructions for conscious and aware unification with the spirit?
I'm so glad you asked. What this article reminded me of was the teachings of the Buddha. So I have here the Four Noble Truths and the Eight Ways to get there. So the Noble Truths, we know there is suffering. Suffering is common to all. The cause of suffering, we are the cause of our suffering. The end of suffering is to stop doing what causes us suffering. And the path to that suffering, everyone can be enlightened. So it goes on to different kinds of suffering, which we all know. And the Eightfold Path tells us we need to follow each step, and there are eight of them, to make this happen within us. And this requires concentration and awareness and that inner spirit guiding and reminding the lower nature of what to do. The first one is right view. The right way to think about life is to see the world through the eyes of the Buddha with wisdom and compassion. So we're told we reincarnate with those we love and those we don't like so much. So if we treated them both the same, then we're working in concert with nature. The second is right thought. We are what we think. Clear and kind thoughts build good, strong characters. And that's all the time, clear and kind thoughts. You see someone on the bus with no hair, struggling to move, and you're in a hurry. You know, come on. Can you for a moment imagine what that soul went through to become in that condition for that period of time? The compassion, the clear thinking allows us to, again, treat them the way we would want to be treated. The third is right speech. By speaking kind and helpful words, we are respected and trusted by everyone. So if we are communicating truth, again, we're working in harmony with what will bring this about. Bear with me. Right conduct. It's a tough one. No matter what we say, others know us from how we behave. Before we criticize others, we should first see what we do ourselves. And that's that from the article about looking outside for the cause of my suffering. Look inside for the cause of your suffering. Number five is right livelihood. Buddha said, do not earn your living by harming others. Do not seek happiness by making others unhappy. Choose a job that does not hurt others. Now that's tough for the scientist who has to take animals, which are souls with spirit, and experiment on them for the greater good, but it depends on the ethics and the morals while doing their job. Right effort. A worthwhile life means doing our best at all times and having goodwill toward others. It also means not wasting effort on things that harm ourselves and others. So how are we using our time? What are we thinking about? Thoughts are things. They create actions. Again, it's being concentrated in what we do. 7 is right mindfulness. This means being aware of our thoughts, words, and deeds. And 8 is right concentration. Theosophy would say, when we meditate, focus on one thought or object at a time. By doing this, we can be quiet and attain true peace of mind. And it's a wonderful analogy. Deeds are the ways one cares for the garden we're building. Our faults are the weeds. Pulling out the weeds from the garden, the harvest is real and lasting happiness. So we know we took some time, but we think that's a wonderful study to go along with this. Yes.
We had talked a little bit about desire, and on page 34, the first paragraph that begins with desire, the next to the last sentence, he says, and he says it pretty emphatically too, he says there is never any need to desire. But the article also talked about how everything is dual. So there has to be a higher aspect to desire,
yes,
as well as a lower one.
Yes.
And if there's no desire, then how can there be any action that was just talked about with Rita?
Well,
so we don't quite understand that sentence.
Right. We have to remember that desire as kama, K-A-M-A, is a spiritual part of our nature. It's one of the sevenfold parts of our nature. So it will always exist. The universe started because desire first arose in it. That desire is fueled with everything we need to be working on. It's for the benefit of the soul. So we think the desire that's not needed, as was said, is the lower desires, the personal desires, those that injure others or do everything opposite to what I just read. But yes, desire will always be, because it is a spiritual state. Yes.
Our understanding, as was said by the chair in Theosophy, is yes, desire is always present. It's a principle of nature. And we have found it easy just to finally reach, whenever we see that statement or something like it in so many of the writings and articles, to not desire, to kill out desire, all these kinds of things, really they're talking about the lower desires, as we said. Because like desire, when we break it down, two words that are very helpful to remember. There's desire as ambition, the I, me, my, the I want more, more power, more stuff, more all this. Those are our ambitions. But then there's desire, the higher aspect of the aspirations, the desire to become more, to serve more, so that we can be of greater service, to help and teach others. That's desire. If you didn't have the desire to do it, our understanding is it wouldn't happen. And really, the philosophy tells us that our bundle of higher aspirations and experiences is what we bring with us and assimilate into our very character as we move on from life to life.
Yes, Absolutely, everything that was said is right on point. Was your hand up in the back? No? Okay.
We have heard in these rooms that desire stands behind will. And it seems then that we have to look at that point. It says desire stands behind will. Well, if we do not exercise self-control, desire being the passion that you know, the brain is bad, rajas, the main thing. Good example, I mean, you get into automobile and you turn on the ignition, the car is going to take it anywhere you want to go. But if you do not exercise caution, and you're supposed to be here instead of there, but your desire to be there, the automobile will take you there. So we looked at it from that point of view, that it is self-control.
And remember who's driving the automobile. It said in the article, a funny little aside about a child wanting candy. And once a child learns what candy is, it wants more and more. Even if it has a bellyache, it wants more. But eventually, it gets tired of it. Now it wants something better. Maybe it's ice cream, maybe it's, you know, whatever. But those earthly, terrestrial, personal desires never cease unless we work them out. Now, for the child, it's the responsibility of the parents to say, no, you get one piece of this, and that's it. And a little bit of self-control might be learned by the child. But as an adult, it's really difficult for us. But that desire standing behind will means we are coloring our actions and feelings always with the desire and what we have the motive for to do that. Yes.
I see that the automobile is the vehicle, but the driver is the spirit. What bothers me is that there may be a connection between the spirit and the vehicle, but there's no awareness between the vehicle and the spirit. So what bothers me is that there is none of that awareness, because had there been that awareness, this world would be a much better place. You would be conscious of what is right and what is wrong, on a true, higher conscious level, not just on a comic level, not on the
right.
You know, egotistical level. Why is that not there?
Do you think it's possible?
Of course it's possible. People have done it. Many have.
Exactly. Mr. Judge says, and it's on page 36, give me 500 good, earnest, sincere, devoted, good, earnest, sincere, devoted men and women, and I will move the world. 500 out of the millions and billions that are here. So that is what you described is the case for most of us at this point in our development. But we can never know what another has learned or is acting from. If we afford them the highest that we can, you know, imagine them, and then imagine ourselves as those perfected ones. Now, there are stages of that. We reach one stage and we've conquered something, some part of desire. Now, there's more work to do, but we have tools like access to that spirit, perhaps we didn't have active before. Now we can move higher and so forth. So it's a very slow process and it has everything to do with the ideas we hold. And for the most part, we start out with ideas that people feed us. And with good intention, you know, the parents telling the children what they've learned and so forth. But at some point, we need to take the broom and sweep through those ideas, getting rid of the ones that no longer seem to be true, that aren't helping us, and hold fast to those like these, and it will change the way we live. And the more often we do that, the stronger the connection to that high spiritual instinct, intuition.
Yes.
Yes.
It's often been said that the theosophy is for those who want it, who desire it. And there must be something heard that sort of stirs up that desire. So it seems that if you want it, it shall be yours.
Absolutely. At the very end of the part, some of you have the books. The last sentence reads, "The action is from within outward, and the power goes with the action. No one can save us but ourselves." It's a powerful statement. Way in the back, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, in paragraph 9, which was not actually assigned for today, there's a statement, a couple of statements, about the nature of the brain. The brain has to be made a good conductor for spiritual knowledge. It needs to be clarified. It needs to be made permeable. And this was written a good long time ago. It was based on ancient teachings. And the tickle for this student is there's so much brain research now with the neuroplasticity is the overall term for the science. Providing scientific evidence for how
this
and why
possible.
This is true.
Absolutely. Science catches up, but slowly, to what we learn here. So we're a little bit ahead of the game. But we have to put it to good use. Yes, in the corner.
Savior to make everything better. And it's, you know, we have to take that responsibility on ourselves to change things. We can't blame other people. We can't blame God for what has happened to us. And when we look at all the sorrow in the world, so much of it is because there's that outward direction that people are looking rather than taking the responsibility on themselves.
Absolutely. And if there were a savior in the world, and we don't know if there is right now, but point to the Buddha, Christ, Krishna, when they were on the scene, it was because they were needed to remind us of all these ideas and teachings. but every one of them said, take the teachings and do this yourself. I can't save you. None can save you but yourselves. So we're at a time where maybe we can look at these teachings as a savior, and they are available to us because we called them forth, because we need them. But when we walk out that door, our responsibility becomes putting these into action. And it is not easy, but even if we're told, even if we conquer one bad habit or one desire that plagues us, it changes tremendously our karma for the future. So take one thing and really work it through and make it no longer part of you, and you are then a different person. But it's working from within without. Yes?
We often recall some of our grandparents and our parents, and having once heard these ideas here, and the amazing thing is, where have I heard it before? Because we consider ourselves well-educated, advanced, and so forth, whereas they could hardly write their name.
Mm-hmm.
Yet many of these ideas we see sprinkled through these teachings.
Yeah.
And then we consider how they did it, but we would want that too. So you have to treat this one of those.
The Asfis.
Find out the source of our family's background, education, and the many, many philosophical sounding statements that we have heard. Makes you feel very, very humble.
It is pure Theosophy, and it is for those who want it. We often find those in the most dire circumstances in life being the first to help their neighbor. They see them suffering as well. I made some food, would you like to share it with me? I have some water, do you need some water? Extreme poverty exists on this planet, and it shouldn't. And it's part of the return of impression from past lives. But we can do something about it. There are so many organizations now trying to change those kinds of things. But we agree, even the American Indians had rituals and rites that are directly in line with Theosophy. Absolutely. Yes?
Well, the thought occurred, because of our technology, we are painfully aware of global disasters and tragedies and sorrows. But our sphere of influence is local. It's within our own home, our own workplace, our own neighborhood, our own lodge, or, you know, the concentric circles of activity where we can assist hand in hand, mouth to ear, and hold a dream or a vision of alleviating suffering in all places at all times.
Yes.
And then let go of it.
Yes, absolutely. The impression we send out when we hold and concentrate on an altruistic idea is felt by the world at large. It doesn't just stay in our mind. So if that's all you can do to be of service, do that every night or every morning when you sit for meditation. Include that wish, that altruistic thought, and send it out, and as was said, let it go, which is the hardest thing. That's what today's topic is, let it go, because desire is what we are attached to. So if we can loosen those reins and eventually let the horse run free, we're on the right path. Yes, in the corner. Okay. Yes. What's your original reaction to that? Do we have to take care of our own garden first before we help another? Which better prepares us? We think it would be our own garden, however we envisage that. If we want to, as it said in the Declaration, fit ourselves to be the better able to help and teach others, we learn first the process of planting the seed, watching it grow, weeding it as it grows, as an example. And then when the neighbor needs help, you have the knowledge and the experience to help them in a way you wouldn't if you hadn't done that first. And use that as an analogy for other things. Any other thoughts? Yes. Exactly, because though we have the knowledge inherent within us, there are, what, 15 people in the room in a city of millions? So our neighbor may never have heard or seen an action like you might be able to do to help them. Then they might get curious. Why are you doing this? What's behind all this? And then you can have a conversation on this, and it might be the first time they hear it and want to investigate, or it brings up something within their nature and they begin their journey. It said whenever we talk to someone about reincarnation, there's often an awakening, because it's an eternal truth, whether or not it is understandable on this plane of learning, it's often an opening beginning. Yes.
Also, in the rest of this article, there's a lot of good little lines that come up. In that paragraph 6,
mm-hmm.
Thing to carry around.
justice rules as under the law, and it truly is karma. We wouldn't be receiving any situation, any duty, any thought, had we not at some time put it forward. So the great suffering that comes to us and we cry for justice, we're crying to the outside world, and that's not where it lives. It lives within, in the corner first and then here.
The question about whether to do the garden, do yours first or help somebody else, we don't see why it couldn't be done at the same time. As long as we think your motive is good and you are actively working in your garden, that if somebody came for help, why wouldn't you help? How could you say, no, I'm sorry, I've not done my garden yet, just wait and then I'll do it again? But we think as long as your motive is good and you're trying, I mean, your experience can certainly help somebody else's.
Yes. That is absolutely true. Opportunity knocks for us all the time. And in this situation, while you were planting, another came and said, can you help me do that? Maybe it's beautiful or maybe it's something they hadn't seen before. But we lost our train of thought. But yes, with the right motive, anywhere along the path that we can do that, we gave the overall. But if something arrives on your doorstep, it's your duty, it's your opportunity. So then you say, yes, of course, I would be glad to share what I'm doing. Yes.
And we have another question, but along that line, let's face it, in practical ways, any student who's learning something, of course, they have to put the personal effort to focus and learn it, but people learn according to, do they have an effective teacher? In certain ways, you learn that way. In certain ways, you learn by the effort. But boy, students learn so much more together when they work cooperatively. They can start out knowing very little about a certain subject and know so much more if they work together on the subject. So that's just reality in life. Sometimes we get into this box of theosophy. It's like, oh, I have to do it myself. Nobody else is on the only thing in the universe. And everything comes from me. Well, yeah, but there's another side to it. And it's everything. Everything is everything. So, but our question is, in the part, Mr. Crosby says that these desires, these are the cause of our sorrows and everything, and he says this was not the plan. What was the plan? And why aren't we following the plan? What happened that we're so far off the plan?
Right. In the very beginning of the evolutionary cycle, we heard on Wednesday night that universal mind is active and has a plan, like a grid or a, we might imagine a calendar, something like that. It has a plan for the development of mankind. That does not mean that we will follow right along that plan exactly because of this. The free will of saying, I know I should be doing my homework, but I'm going to listen to a CD instead. Perhaps that was the time for you to do your homework and gain some knowledge, but you went outside the plan. And therefore, the next day when you get in and take the pop quiz, you're going to fail it because you didn't follow what you know you should have done. So let's say the universal ideas or plan is really what we should do, but we're dealing with karma. And every day we're fighting, whether we know it or not, our habits, our tendencies, that which we brought back. So that's one idea. Anybody have another? Yes.
Many, many years ago, a group of young men in the service were taught how to swim.
We're taught
how to
swim.
Or rather, they wanted to know if you could. So they took you on a 20-foot, I guess 15-foot high tower, told you to jump. But if you didn't jump, he took his foot and pushed you. So with one flying, fear, terror, we failed. And they had to jump in and pull us out.
Yeah.
Well, the story goes further to make it short. Those group of men, called submarines, by the way, they used that type of training as a recreation. The pain and the suffering of those few weeks, they kept at it until they were no longer mission. They no longer fear swimming. But it's a very good point here that we learn every failure is success.
Yes.
If we pay attention. And I think that example of those two sailors who were submarines, who eventually became pretty fair. But they knew how to at least go paddle out.
Yeah. We think it was Thomas Edison, correct us if we're wrong, figured out the light bulb on the 100th try. And other people said to him, 100? You tried 99 different ways before you made it work? And he said, well, I learned 99 ways it won't work. Now I know how it does. I mean, that takes some concentration and devotion. Your hand was up?
Yeah, earlier when you said that there was a plan in universal mind. The plan in universal mind manifested through us through law.
Mm-hmm.
Our disobedience to law is what causes our pain and suffering. But out of that pain and suffering, we learn. They are necessary tools for us to follow that law, to get closer to that law, to become more in sync with that law.
Absolutely. If we are suffering, we're doing something wrong. We're on the wrong path. We've taken a left when we should have taken a right. So we need to go back to the middle and reassess the situation and figure out how to do it better the next time. Yes?
On a personal level, it seems to me that if we learn to deal with our own sorrow, and we all experience sorrow for one reason or another, then we have to live through it and accept it and work through it. And that experience will help us to assist other people in dealing with their moments of sorrow, or their
yes.
times of sorrow.
Absolutely. And, you know, it is said mankind is never without a friend. So we have the assistance, where possible, not to interfere with karma, of those perfected beings. And the more we ideate them, the closer we become to them. And it is suffering, but remember, it's illusion. Everything we see with the mortal eyes is illusion. What happens to the suffering when we conquer it? Where does it go? It's all of a sudden clear that that wasn't actually real. It was a feeling. It was a wrong turn, however you want to put it. But if we are working in harmony with nature, our eyes are a little bit clearer, that middle path that Buddha talks about. So it helps to remember this is illusion. It's going to hurt, but it's only going to hurt for a certain amount of time. And when we learn to see clearly where we go and what we should be doing, that pain subsides at least a little bit. We have time for one more. Okay, in the big book that these teachings are in, the friendly philosopher has the eternal verities, which is the universal theosophy, in it. And before those in the book is a powerful quote from the Gita, and it's Krishna talking to Arjuna. When thy heart shall have worked through the snares of delusion, then thou wilt attain to high indifference as to those doctrines which are already taught or which are yet to be taught. It is even the same exhaustless, secret, eternal doctrine I have this day communicated unto thee, because thou art my devotee and my friend. So we are never without a friend. Remember that this is illusion. We can conquer it, and we can always do better. 1 minute left. Anybody? Yes.
It seems to me that the entire paradox is that we learn within the illusion.
Yes.
Had we not been in the illusion and, say, been not there, all the knowledge of the universe is available to us.
Yes.
We can't learn or practice it unless we are in the illusion.
Yes. But the only way we reach that nirvanic bliss is to work through these ideas. We're born with all of that knowledge that you mentioned, but it's internal. That's why we always say from within outwards. That lower mind has to become in sync with the higher mind by realizing those ideas. And then we can act in a way in harmony and peace with the universe and have peace and quiet for ourselves. Meeting adjourned.